This is the NCARB podcast, where you get an inside look at licensure, regulation, and the initiatives shaping the future of architectural practice. I'm your host, Andy McIntyre, Vice President of Marketing and Communications at NCARB. And this season, we're diving into Pathways to Practice, NCARB's multi-year effort to rethink how architects become licensed.
Architecture is the hardware to the software of life, right? It is fundamentally about that interaction, and it makes life easier if we have a built environment that works.
Across 8 episodes, we'll explore how licensure got to where it is today and where it needs to go next. We talk with architects, educators, regulators, and NCARB leaders about education, experience, and the exam, and why each of those pillars is evolving.
And that portion of school where you go from conceptual to real is also really challenging. It's not something you're really gently moved into. It's kind of like you're doing something that's flowy and crazy, and all of a sudden, wait, you actually have to make this work.
You'll hear how the NCARB competency standard was developed, how research is shaping future licensure models, and what a more flexible, competency-based approach could mean for candidates from a wide range of backgrounds.
So we've seen that in our data as the number of reciprocal licenses starts to decrease a little bit, but that number of individuals who are licensed holds steady.
We also tackle the big questions. Why does licensure look the way it does today? Where do candidates face the biggest barriers? And how can we expand access without lowering standards?
Not everybody fits into the same mold. And so having different pathways to licensure, I think, is really important.
Whether you're a licensure candidate, an educator, a firm leader, or a regulator, this season offers clarity, context, and transparency into one of the most important conversations facing the profession.
Does this requirement to complete all divisions of the exam place an unfair burden on any one group or other?
This is Pathways to Practice, only on the NCARB podcast. Please follow the link in the show notes, subscribe now, and join us as we explore the future of architectural licensure.
I would like to design a green room in my like, who gives a shit?
Oh my gosh, you're like drunk tired. I love it.
It's like midnight. It's almost 1 Oh, it's 1 a.m.
I know. Let's go.
Okay.
Yeah. Let go.
Hey there, and welcome back to She Builds Podcast, where we share stories about women in the design and construction field, one lady at a time. This season, we will be discussing business bosses and leaders. In today's episode, we will talk about Dorothy Draper. She is considered to be the first to establish interior design to be a profession and to have the first interior design company in the United States. I'm Jessica Rogers, waiting to eat a burger based out of Miami, Florida.
Hey there, I'm Lizzie Rahr, looking forward to doing some quilting in San Francisco.
And I'm Nurjiti Rivas. I cannot wait to learn about Dorothy and then shower and go to sleep after this in Houston, Texas. It's past my bedtime. I'm tired.
It's okay. We'll get through this.
But I'm excited for the story.
Yeah, I'm surprised we're here, guys.
So, let's do it.
We're gonna do what to do.
Now for our disclaimer. The three of us are not historians, nor are we experts on this subject. We are just sharing stories about the information that we find about each woman. If we get our facts a little mixed up, please forgive us, leave us a comment, and we will all continue learning together.
All right. So, ladies, I hope you have your debutante gowns, white gloves, and your petticoats left. Huh? Because today we are dabbling in the world of the rich and famous. Okay.
Ooh, pour me a dry martini and let's get this ball started.
Oh, my. Let me ready myself.
Yes, honey.
Gracious.
The levels of fabulosity in this episode will be unmatched. Okay, so let's begin.
I want to mention that this is a sort of listener episode requested. It was serendipitous, this episode, because a listener requested it and we were already in the works for it. So you're welcome, listeners. Keep asking for more. We'll give it to you.
We give it to you. Okay. Dorothy Tuckman was born on November 22nd, 1889, in Tuxedo Park, New York. Have y'all ever heard of Tuxedo Park? Does anything come to mind?
I mean, talk about being born into wealth. Can't get any more high class than being born in Tuxedo Park. I mean, what kind of fancy place is that?
Yeah, they were like, we need to let everyone around us know just how wealthy we are by naming our town something classy. Classiness so classy. Only.
Well, it is said that this place was the birthplace of the tuxedo.
Oh,
okay. It,
mm-hmm.
There you go. Appropriate. Appropriate.
Yep, there it is. Yep. On brand. It's also considered one of the first gated communities in the United States. For it to be just 40 miles outside of New York City, Tuxedo Park was the place for the social elites to live in these cottage style homes, aka mansions.
Oh, wow.
Is that an oxymoron? Like a cottage style mansion? But
yeah,
it's just like, I just Googled it.
I mean, I'm picturing something like the Hamptons.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it feels like a lot of houses in River Oaks. The River Oaks is a fancy place of town in Houston. It's like our tuxedo place.
I see.
And they have like these cottage style looking mansions. Just still like these pictures like I'm seeing. I know.
It still sounds like an oxymoron. But okay, listen, I'm trying to paint the picture of where this our homegirl came from. Okay. She came from money, y'all.
Well, got I it. Think you're doing a good job. Yeah.
Yep. Okay, great success.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. So Dorothy was the daughter of Paul Tuckerman, who was the descendant of Oliver Wolcott, one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence.
Oh, so maybe she was one of those daughters of the revolution like Lizzie. Is that what the group is called?
Daughters of the American Revolution, the DAR.
I was close. Yeah, like that. Close. Like Emily Gilmore.
That's right.
Okay. Anyway, for 9 years, Dorothy would be an only child and her family would call her Star. Eventually, her parents would have a son, Roger, that would become the father of Nancy Tuckerman, who would become Jackie Kennedy's White House social secretary. And well, actually, she was basically her bestie from my research on Nancy. They would grow up together.
Oh, man, all these connections.
Yeah.
Okay. First of all, I had no idea that there was a social secretary.
Yeah.
Does every important person in the executive branch get a social secretary or just the first lady? Or did they make up that position for Jackie's best friend?
It's definitely something that the first wives get or the first spouses. And they help. This person helps them with all of their like first ladies or
events.
Yeah. For all their social events. So Jackie had one social secretary, but then eventually she requested for her bestie to join her, aka Dorothy's niece.
Do you think Doug has a secretary, a social secretary, or maybe not because he's the second gentleman, not the first?
I mean, I think it comes with this position. So I'm sure the vice president's spouse, or in this case, the second gentleman would have one. I do wonder what kind of parties he would throw as the second gentleman. But all I know was the Kennedys had some fantastic parties. And this was just Dorothy's niece. I'm telling you, Dorothy's family just came from money. Even just briefly looking at her maternal side of the family, they were merchants. They owned steamship companies. That they were also a part of the Panama Canal Railway Company. Money.
Money, 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 money.
Money.
money. Okay, so I just wanted to give you guys some insight into Dorothy's life because her upbringing would be similar to our episode 5 lady, Mariana Griswold Van Rensselaer.
Mariana was a landscape architecture critic and full of money and privilege. You like talking about rich ladies, Jessica, don't you?
Yes, I'm sensing a theme.
Right?
I mean, I love talking about the lifestyles of the rich and famous, okay? Maybe that's what it is. Yeah. Maybe, I don't know, you know, live vicariously through them.
Okay.
But anyway, so basically, as an American aristocrat / social elite, Dorothy was expected to get a basic education taught by private tutors and whatnot. And of course, travel to Europe and being all fancy-like.
As one does.
Yeah, I mean, elite and glamour is all Dorothy. She was 6 foot tall, beauty, looked like a movie star, and hanging out in all the right circles.
Ooh.
So, yep, at the age of 23, Dorothy would marry Dr. George, nicknamed Dan Draper.
Oh, a doctor. Okay, but is Dan a nickname for George? That's the weirdest one I've heard yet. It must be a middle name. Like,
maybe.
Come on now.
Yeah. Who knows?
Yeah, I didn't pay that much attention to his name. But what I did find was that not only was he a doctor, but he was the BFF of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Yeah.
This doctor, Dr. Dan Draper, specialized in treating polio. So actually, he is the one that's credited to be the president's doctor that helped treat his illness.
Okay, you know, just a casual connection. I mean, all these rich people know each other.
I know, right? This is what's going on in this episode.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, rich people know rich people.
They really do.
I guess middle-class people know us middle-class people. You know?
That's why we know each other.
Such insights.
We know them all.
We know them all. Yeah, pretty much. What's up? Okay. Well, anyway. Okay. So after getting married, Dorothy and George would move to Manhattan in a gorgeous brownstone just around the corner from where the Roosevelts lived, which, by the way, I also found out that Eleanor Roosevelt was Dorothy's cousin and her childhood friend.
Oh, gosh.
This is what I'm telling you. Everybody knows everybody. All the rich people. They just know each other.
There's just not enough of them. There's only like 1%.
It's true. That's how they know each other.
That's the key. You just nailed it right there. There's only that 1%.
So we need more rich people. I want to be rich.
Yeah, me too. I want to know.
Do you though? Like,
yeah, not really.
I mean, I want money. But anyway, I don't know if I could be rich with life. I am rich. Rich with life. Okay, anyway. I said a gorgeous brownstone because obviously we're talking about a woman that would be later that, you know, she knew the Roosevelts. She wasn't living in a brownstone shack. She was living in a gorgeous brownstone. And this woman, she would later be called the original Martha Stewart, if you catch my drift. Oh. And that's a quote.
Oh, wow. What a title.
Fabulous.
Yep. Okay. Dorothy was all about making the world a better place while her husband cured diseases and her bestie / cousin's husband was off becoming president. Dorothy believed, and this is a quote, "Your home is the backdrop of your life, whether it's a palace or a one-room apartment," end quote. So early in her marriage, she would begin renovating this Manhattan brownstone that they moved into.
Well, I have to say, I completely agree with Dorothy. I mean, we spend, 60% of our lives where we live, maybe more now with pandemic and work from home, all of that. But that's one of the reasons I always really liked residential architecture. I mean, where you live should function well for you, just like any public space.
I wish I could find photos of this place, But to neighbors and friends, it would just be nicknamed the Upside Down House. Because, yeah, let me explain. Because she basically pushed and extended the first floor of the house to take up the backyard space, right? She would then, in turn, she would open up the interiors to allow for, say, 100 close friends slash guests to hang out in her fabulous parties that Dorothy would throw.
I'm like, my brain first went to, this sounds like a project that happened before zoning laws. No setback requirements. She just pushed the first floor to the backyard. Goodbye. Like, take it out. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, I'm going to say strange tangent alert. We need a sound for that.
I don't know what it is.
I don't know.
I just finished binging Stranger Things. So my first thought was that her house was possessed by the Flayer or whatever.
Like, you go inside the house and the Mind Flayer can find you now? Is that?
Yeah, like you're in the Upside Down.
I did. Well, I will say, I also just started the new season. And when she said Upside Down House, I was like, oh, yeah. Stranger
Things. Went there, you see?
I did.
Yeah, that's some scary stuff. But Jessica's explanation makes more sense. It kind of sounds like the Great Gatsby sort of house.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to go with that instead of the whatever y'all are talking about.
With the Mind Flayer and the Demodogs? You don't want that?
Yeah, no. This, wait, remember, debutante gowns, dramatinis.
We're taking it away.
Fabulosity, not whatever y'all talking about. Yeah. Okay. Think more Great Gatsby, okay?
All right.
Because basically, the reason why it's called the Upside Down House and not whatever y'all talking about is because she basically took that garden that was in the backyard and she moved it to be on the roof of the first floor extended area. So you get it, taking it from the first floor to the top.
Okay, I understand the name better now. And I'm imagining Gatsby-esque parties everywhere.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, classiness.
You know, talking about green roofs, I would like to design a green roof in my career. They're just so nice and they help catch rainwater and there's so many good things about them. A lot of constraints too, but that's okay. Just saying, green roofs, it's where it's at. Good job, Dorothy.
It's where it's at. And, you know, we're just getting started, right? And there's also, okay, so the popularity of the Upside Down House would become basically Dorothy's launching point for her career. People respected Dorothy's social status and her connection brought a lot of great appeal to the elite. They wanted Dorothy's help to renovate their own spaces.
That's so much fun. Her house was like her portfolio.
Yeah.
I think that I know a few interior designers that started their careers in this organic way. Like,
yeah,
doing a little bit of this in their home and a little bit of that.
For a friend, you know.
Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Boom. And that's how it starts. Okay. So like in 1925, Dorothy, or Dee Dee, as a lot of folks nicknamed her.
Dee Dee
would start her business from her home called Architectural Clearinghouse, which was kind of like an agency where Dorothy would pair architects with high affluent society women that wanted to renovate their homes.
Wait, that feels like a U-turn. Why was she recommending other people? Was it because the projects were some large renovations, space planning and structure involved? Like, she didn't want to get touch that?
Yeah, like, it sounds like she became a dating service for architects. I'm confused about this turn of events.
Yeah.
Okay, let me explain. Okay, so one, it kind of was like a dating
service for architects.
Service for architects.
That sounds like a good service, though.
Right?
Slash clients, though. It was kind of like she was a matchmaker.
Yeah. Right. Well, that's what I mean.
What it was?
But for both, because they mutually wanted services done or performed. But Let me preface that Dorothy was the type that didn't like to feel restricted, okay? She wanted to escape the shackles of the gated communities of the country's elite, okay, such as Tuxedo Park. With her husband... with her husband, the one that treated the president, she wanted to live in the gritty arena of the Upper East Side. To challenge social norms. So she didn't want to deal with annoying clients fulfilling their requests when she wanted to design boldly. Okay.
Okay.
So that's why she didn't want to deal with clients. And basically, her architecture matchmaking business would become Dorothy Draper and Company, where Dorothy would design, instead of people's homes and whatnot, she would design hotels and resorts. Because basically, hospitality was more of her game.
Okay, I get it. So she liked the big scale work, which was probably... not a greeny arena that a lot of women were involved in.
Yeah. Okay. So she just didn't want to answer to individual clients who had their own, like, preferences. Also, the Upper East Side is so gritty. I mean...
tell me about it.
Ooh.
Oh, you guys caught that? Okay.
I think we did.
She's really slumming it.
Slumming it. Okay. Well, anyway.
Maybe Dorothy, when you come from Tuxedo Park, you know?
Oh, yeah. People don't wear tuxedos every day. What? Anyway, Dorothy would love the creative freedom of designing hotel lobbies and large communal spaces. She would say, big projects for a big personality.
Maybe I'll start telling my bosses that. I need big projects that fit my big personality. Please and thank you.
Let us know how that goes.
Yeah, please. Please report back.
You know when I'm fun employed.
Okay. So anyway, in 1928, Dorothy would take on the lobby of the Carlisle Hotel, a project she got through her friend, a real estate magnate, Douglas Elliman. Okay, so are there any real estate folks out there? This name should sound familiar. Or if you're not into real estate like that, are there any fans of the Million Dollar Listing franchise on Bravo like me? This name should also ring a bell.
I think that in this audience right here, right now, there are no big fans of any of that.
Nope.
I have no idea.
Never heard
Douglas
of Douglas.
Is. Yeah. Nope. But it sounds like a big deal that Dorothy was working on a big deal hotel.
Yeah, I'm right? excited that you're excited.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Tell us.
Okay. Okay. So Douglas Elliman, I'm not sure if I'm saying his last name right, but this firm, this brokerage is a huge brokerage, like top five, maybe top real estate brokerage worldwide, at least in the United States. If you're a fan of Million Dollar Listing, New York and L.A. Frederick, that's the brokerage that he works for.
Oh,
anyway, I love this show. But anyway, the name, it rang a bell because it still exists today.
Cool.
All right. Anyway, okay, this is just. I'm just going to give you an idea of the aesthetic of the lobby, okay? Because the lobby of this hotel had these bold black and white marble floor tiles.
Love it.
The space had this gorgeous chandeliers and marble columns, oversized mirrors, satin and velvet furniture everywhere.
I wouldn't have imagined anything less decadent for Dorothy.
It's so true. She wouldn't have left her fabulosity behind over in Tuxedo Park now that she's slumming it in the Upper East Side.
No way.
I know, that's right. Mm-hmm. You can take the girl out of Tuxedo Park, but you can't take the Tuxedo Park out of the girl.
That's right.
That's right. Okay. So what was great with these commercial developers and architects that she was working with was that they trusted the, quote, Draper touch. Oh. which, yeah, and working with mostly men, obviously, because we're talking about developers, they appreciated the feminine touch that Dorothy could provide to these spaces. Her reputation and her societal connections, they knew that with her help, she would be able to bring in future customers and consumers.
Ooh, that Draper touch sounds like a good slogan. So she was being rightfully recognized for her unique talent and hard work. I like this a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like she had a lot of clout.
Oh, yeah. And that project, the Carlisle Hotel, would basically solidify her life's work, right? Because originally, these hotel lobby spaces, you know, they were seen as these bland pass-through places that you didn't want to stay in too long. But Dorothy would transform them into eye-catching gathering spaces, a standard that I believe you can see now in most modern hotels that try to create models of, like, what do they call it? Hotel living as a lifestyle, where guests can feel like they belong in a place that is miles away from their homes.
So are you saying Dorothy started the concept of like fancy hotel lobbies?
That's crazy.
Yep, that's true.
I cannot imagine a fancy hotel with a bland entrance or lobby. It just doesn't make any sense.
Right.
In Puerto Rico, growing up, we would hang out in the lobbies of the hotels just because it was nice to be in there. There was air conditioner.
Yeah.
It was pretty. Yeah. I actually like checking out hotel lobbies sometimes when I'm traveling. Maybe I just walk into the hotel. Yeah. Maybe that's weird. But you guys just agree with me. So maybe it's not that weird.
It's not weird at all.
I appreciate Dorothy so much more now because she's changed my life. I didn't even know.
She brought you
life-changing hotel lobbies.
Yeah. What was I going to do if not that?
Just pass through them.
Yeah, I mean, that's crazy that she's the one who started it. I feel like hotel lobbies and then eventually restaurants, right, are a big draw for even non-guests. Mm-hmm. Exactly what you're saying, Nurjiti, right? Like, people go to visit hotels just to kind of, like, hang out in the lobby, have dinner and that kind of thing.
Some drinks. And,
yeah, they're just, like, being welcomed by this great lobby space. It would be weird if that didn't exist.
Exactly.
Okay, so that project was in 1928. She would also work on another project, which proved that great style doesn't necessarily have to be for those elite hotel goers. Because, okay, so in the same year, she would take on a renovation to a group of tenement houses on the far east side of Manhattan. Not to downplay what she did, but y'all, she basically painted the exteriors black with white windowsill trim and changed the gross hallways to a more refreshed area with beautiful wallpaper and floral carpets.
Well, yeah, we can't underestimate the power of a small change in a space. It can change the entire feel and function. Just changing the color can be really powerful.
Totally.
Okay, so the beauty of this was that the owners of these tenements, known as Sutton Place, they were struggling to get people to rent it at only $15 a month, which was, which I guess technically today it's like $258. I'd love to have that rent.
Yeah.
Anyway, after Dorothy got her hands on the project, the owner was able to fully occupy these houses with tenants at four times the cost.
You see, there you go. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, Dorothy, change how they see it.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, Dorothy had something great brewing, but then it's 1929, and you guys know what happened in 1929 in the U.S.
Oh, yeah. The stock market crash, and that started the Great Depression. I always remember because Rose's jerk fiance, whatever his name was, ended his life after he lost his money in the crash. And you know what? That actually happened to a lot of people. So,
yes,
I'm a little bit scared of where the story's going now.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it seems like Kate and Leo come up a lot on our podcast, guys.
Because, yeah, they, I mean, their story's relevant.
Yeah.
Their story's often relevant. I mean, Kate and Leo from the Titanic definitely come up in our conversations all the time because there was definitely room for him. But anyway. So not only did the stock market crash in 1929, but Dorothy divorced George, or Dan Draper. And, well, in most of my accounts that I read, they said that George left Dorothy for another woman.
Oh, no.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? Good riddance, Dorothy, because in my brief George research I did a few minutes ago when you mentioned him, I learned that he was involved in eugenics. So she is definitely better off without him.
Oh, no. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, mm-hmm. Dorothy, get out of there. Get out of there. Did they have kids?
Yeah. So Dorothy had 3 kids. And I didn't find out much more about the other kids. But yeah, 1929 proved to be a lot. The market crashes. Her husband leaves her. She also ends up selling that gorgeous brownstones. And actually, she ends up moving into one of those houses that she renovated that I just mentioned with her youngest daughter.
Oh, so she moved into the Sutton place? I hope that they gave her the friends and family discount.
Oh, but that's sad to lose her portfolio piece. But I guess she traded one project for another in terms of like living in your project.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. And to answer your question, Judy, I mean, she did get a good discount because she brought in the great business. You know, she had turned this shabby place to something chic and beautiful.
Yeah. How she's living for free.
Maybe not that far because, you know, she did have
she could afford some money.
She could afford it. At, you know, 4 times $15 a month. Like, girl. But anyway.
They need it more
like
than her.
They need it more than her. But anyway, regardless, we are talking about her, right? So, like all of our ladies on this show, this didn't get her down. Like, seriously, I think our show, we should have named it She Builds Resilient Podcast or something. Because that's what our ladies are.
Resilient women. Yeah. Maybe that should have been the name of our company instead of She Builds LLC.
Yeah, maybe.
The next one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, for the next business. Okay, so in one of my sources that I read, it said that after her divorce, that's when she officially changed her company name to Dorothy Draper & Co. But she did start seeing this psychiatrist called Dr. Norman Vincent Peale, and he would become popular because of this book that he published called The Power of Positive Thinking.
Ah, good for you, Dorothy.
Positive vibes are starting to come from Dorothy.
Dorothy would feel inspired by this book and to have a separate venture that would be like the self-help correspondence course.
The patient becomes the master.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. This took a different turn than I thought.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that they were dating.
No, I mean,
when you mentioned it.
I just thought it was going to be like she was going to have this like self-awareness now and be positive about her life. Well, but
that part is true, because you'll see how it plays out in the rest of her things. It's also really interesting that we have this season on business owners and leaders, because she had her, you know, her little renovation, interior, hospitality design business or whatever. And then she started to create this new business with like self-help course. Uh-huh. And this self-help course was short-lived because it ended up being a disaster, actually.
Oh, no.
Because she was so good that after only doing the first two issues, no one wanted to continue her course because they felt healed from Dorothy's teachings.
I mean, I think she just needed a wider reach, more clients.
Not,
yeah. I can't imagine. There's no way no one else needed self-help as seen by today's interest in it. Like,
tell me about it. She was too early on it.
She was too early.
Yeah.
She was too early. But also, I want to know what this course was, because if after the first two lessons I feel healed, she must have did something right, but not so right business
What's
sense.
The secret? Like,
I don't know. I need to really find that, because maybe that's what it is. But maybe self-help gurus don't want to tell you, because then they would lose their business.
She realized it was too good.
It was too good. But anyway, you know, yes, it was a bummer for sure. But, you know, Dorothy, she still had other projects, you know, like her original business, which was that interior design business.
Good, good. She had her business venture to fall back on.
Right.
Yes. And, you know, yeah, sure. Her interior design business was definitely a struggle, too. I mean, we are talking about after the stock market crash.
Yeah.
She was able to work on these renovation projects, but they weren't getting that return like before. But again, it was the economy, right?
Yeah.
Of course, we remember the job market for us after the crash of 2008.
Mm-hmm.
Sadly, architecture and interior design can be seen as a luxury, so it's not something people feel they need necessarily. So our profession suffers greatly during a recession.
Yeah. That's really true. I hope she was able to get a few projects going at least to keep her afloat during that time.
Yeah, so she did. By the mid-1930s, the economy is bouncing back in a way. Ooh. Hotels and resorts were becoming popular again because, which I found really interesting, staying in these like swanky resort hotels would actually be a cheaper alternative than, say, owning and maintaining your own country home or beachside villa.
Yeah.
You know, staying in for a couple of nights versus owning a piece of property. I can definitely see that.
Yeah.
Plus, the other thing that was fascinating is, you know, deciding to vacation in the U.S. at the time of, you know, the Great Depression, World Wars, it was much safer solution to stay in the U.S. than try to vacation at a war-ridden country or countries in Europe.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yes. Okay. So I'm sure, you know, her husband's bestie, Roosevelt, had some say into it, too. But just like atmospherically, what's happening in the hospitality industry and worldwide, this is what I saw.
Yeah.
As what was happening. But anyway, okay, so for some noteworthy projects from Dorothy in New York, she would work on the Hampshire House on Central Park South. On the West Coast, Dorothy would work on two notable projects in San Francisco, the Mark Hopkins Hotel and the Fairmont.
Oh, Julia Morgan's Fairmont? I'm assuming she did a renovation, since this would have been 30 years after Julia helped rebuild the hotel, right? But that's so cool that they worked on the same project. Also,
yes.
Mark Hopkins Hotel is a very fancy hotel here, too. And there's like a fancy restaurant at the top called the Top of the Mark.
So our adventures list.
Yeah.
Yes. When we want to be fancy, because levels to our fabulosity.
Listeners, if you don't remember Julia Morgan, you need to listen to episode 3.
Yes. If you don't, what are you doing? But anyway, this is so cool when I found that out. I literally gasped when I saw Fairmont and Dorothy Draper's name, because I had so many questions. And you know how we love a good crossover overlap, just to see how our ladies may have intertwined. But also, the Fairmont Hotel, it's a boutique hotel. And think about it. It was started by two sisters at the beginning. Like, that's just the beginning of the birth of the Fairmont.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And then,
I didn't either.
Yes. I so went into like a deep dive. But yeah, I love the connections to this theme, to our ladies. It was great.
Love this sisterhood of women in all aspects of the Fairmont Hotel.
Yeah. We need like a chart of like people, like all the ladies and how they're connected, ooh, you know?
Ooh, yeah. A web.
A web.
Of
That's it.
A web of womenosity. I don't know, I just made up a word. Of she builders.
Yes.
Well, anyway, some of her other projects in the West Coast would be like the interiors for the Arrowhead Springs in Redlands, California. That would become like a playground and escape for the Hollywood elites.
OMG, I can't wait to visit all these projects. I need to visit.
Ooh, fancy. If we visit, does that mean that we're part of the elite?
Yes.
Yes. Or at least I'm going to pretend to be.
Ostensibly.
Yeah. Well, according to how fancy these places are, we need to just to, you know.
Act the part.
Be.
Yeah, we wear our best.
They sound we wear our best.
We wear our
they
best.
They sound expensive.
Selves.
Yeah. Yeah, they sound expensive. So we have to have, you know. Anyway. Well, to answer your question, though, Najdi, yes, we can visit. If you're ever in New York, we can check out the Carlisle, the Camellia House at the Drake Hotel in Chicago.
Ooh.
You can go. And then the Greenbrier in White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia is a hotel that's pretty much still intact. In fact, also get this, her company still exists today. And they come to make sure that this resort, this hotel, still looks as beautiful as it did in the beginning.
What?
Yes.
Hold the phone. Her company still exists? This is like so awesome. I'm about to go on such a deep dive. Let's like pause this episode right now so I can go research and let's come back
chasing
in a few hours.
Waterfall.
Sure, but I need to go to sleep soon. But
I'm gonna turn on my
candle. I need to talk to you guys about this place, the Greenbrier, because for one, this was like the pinnacle of Dee Dee's career.
Dee
Dee equals Dorothy. With this project, she would earn the highest pay ever given to a decorator. Okay.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. Yeah. Money. See, even like if she wasn't blowing money, she was making money. Just anyway, everything at the Greenbrier is very Victorian theme and filled with red and greens, large plaster elements, which actually, I don't think I have even mentioned what her style was coined. It was coined modern Baroque. You know, think very ornate, bold, bright, and colorful. But not like a period piece ornate, but with like clean lines still. Maybe like a la Marvelous Miss Maisel, for those that watch that show. You know, she was definitely a maximalist, but in the most tasteful way. You know, that honestly, I still see today. Like, I think of like the Kelly Wesslers, you know?
Yeah, that also made me think of Kelly. Modern Baroque sounds like when a client tells me they want classical modern or wood industrial, traditional contemporary. And I'm like, okay. But I just looked it up. And it really does look like modern Baroque, if there's such a thing.
There is.
Honestly, that is not two things I would have put together, but I'm glad that Dorothy had an eye for that and that she found a way to express that and that there were people to be receptive to it. I know a few designers that I think Dorothy would definitely influence, whether they know it or not.
Yeah, it does kind of sound like an oxymoron when you say that.
Yeah.
But I mean, I guess that's a sign of a good designer, right? When they can merge seemingly disparate styles and then make them look purposeful and cohesive. So it sounds like Dorothy knew what she was doing.
You're right. You're totally right.
Mm-hmm. She definitely knew what she was doing. Okay. So, like, one more thing about this hotel. One, the Victorian writing room was once called the most photographed room in the United States. And it's still there and looks exactly how it did back then.
Oh, so can we go see it and photograph it to help it keep its status?
We have to.
Right? I mean, we got to keep it.
It's
alive.
Our duty. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, it's still there. So how else would we know if it looked exactly how it did back then? So why not? Okay. So, like, another thing about this palace, right? Or this hotel was that when it opened, they basically had a 3-day party, which was attended by the Duke and Duchess of Windsor and Bing Crosby.
Gee whiz. This would have made it on all the media today.
Yeah, I mean, they meant business with a 3-day party. I mean, it sounds like it was probably a great time.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, like I said at the beginning of this episode, the levels of fabulosity of this episode, they're unmatched.
We should have made a really bingo are. Game to see how many times Jessica would say levels of fabulosity during this episode.
We should have taken
that's better
a shot.
Because I was going to say, if we did this a drinking game, everybody be drunk.
That's right.
Don't drink and drive. Don't operate heavy machinery when listening to this episode. Could you about to get drunk?
But the levels really are unmatched.
No, they are. I just was laughing about it.
We've talked about prestigious ladies before, but I think this one might definitely take the cake.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and I feel like I'm barely scratching the surface with her, but I do want to briefly talk about just a few more projects. So there's the cafeteria at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. That got the Draper touch. Unfortunately, I couldn't actually find photos of that one. But also one of her last projects was the International Hotel at Idlewild Airport, which is now the JFK Airport in New York City.
I used to love spending my days at the Met. I went there often when I was living in New York. So I wish I would have known this then, because I would have made sure to take pictures in the cafeteria. But
yep.
Next time I'm there, I'm so doing that. Or also, listeners, if you're in New York and you want to send us pictures of the cafeteria of the Met, that would be great. We'll share it on social media.
Please do.
We'll see Dorothy projects. Please, please.
Yeah, or tag us.
Yeah.
Okay. So, in 1969, Dorothy would pass away at the age of 80. In 2006, she would become the first interior designer to be honored with a retrospective exhibition of her work called The High Style of Dorothy Draper. That would be at the Museum of the City of New York.
What a fabulous legacy she left behind. A pioneer of modern Baroque and of interior design as a profession. I really enjoyed listening and learning about her today, despite how late it is and how tired I am.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I love hearing about all the high society, but also about how she spearheaded this profession and created her own unique style that sounded like it didn't work, but it did.
Mm-hmm.
The style worked. You'll see her influences.
I believe it.
Everywhere.
I believe it.
But okay, what I didn't tell y'all was that Dorothy had also published not one, but 3 books. One of the books was called Decorating is Fun, and that was published in 1939.
That's cute.
And yeah, right? It was basically a design manual for housewives, but it was like kind of like the type of self-help book for insecure, like, homemakers. And yeah, it's cute. Her first rule of decorating was courage. You know, that was her first rule, courage. She really wanted to, like, instill confidence in homemakers. So, like, another thing that she would say in the book was that, you know, it's far better to live with disapproval of a stuffy relative than the oppression of a dark and cluttered home.
I mean, I agree that decorating is fun. So the title would get me.
Yeah.
Right?
And those sound like a really good read.
Right?
It also sounds like, though, that she kind of wrapped her self-help knowledge of her second career thing into this book. And she, like, sort of merged them. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, yeah. I like her advice. It really does take a lot of courage to listen to your design intuition and to put your ideas out there. But in your home, the only person that needs to be happy is you and your family. So go for it. Be positive. Help yourself in your home with your decorating. I don't know.
No, Judy's tired. Okay, so I do want to give a shout out to Carlton Varney. Dorothy was his mentor, and he would actually be the one to carry out her legacy. And he's, you know, the current president of Dorothy Draper & Co. today. In my research, I kept coming across his name so much, and it was helpful because to learn who this woman was, I learned it through what he was able to provide. But I do want to end with this quote from Architectural Digest from him. "Dorothy was a powerhouse," continues Varney, "but there is something that she had that most others didn't. She was glamorous, with this movie star face, wearing long capes and white gloves." Later it says, "And was Dorothy Draper happy? Dorothy was enchanted with her life. She was doing what she liked and never had a single doubt about who she was. And let's face it, from the beginning, she had a leg up big time. Most decorators like to believe that they grew up in a big house on a hill with white columns, wore white suits, and walked down to a lake with swans. Very not true. But Dorothy did, and turned it into a business."
Wow. I mean, he's definitely painting like the picture of her both as a businesswoman, but also like her personality, her upbringing. And I can see how they all came together for her to be such a lasting force in the industry. I mean, right?
I mean,
you're right.
Yeah. And honestly, you're right. And also, like, I feel like some parts I might have exaggerated how fabulous she was, but I'm not the only one that thought that. Like, her mentee thought the same thing. So I'm not just saying it because, you know, I'm not at the Dorothy Draper levels, you know, my parents work and stuff. So
we believe you, Jessica. I mean? Yeah, yeah. Yeah. You're not exaggerating. So you're just stating facts.
Stating facts. She was walking down lakes with swans and stuff.
Yeah, that really got me.
I don't really wear gloves when it's cold and when I do the dishes. So
you don't have levels of fabulosity. That's sorry to say.
Not yet. I'm working on it. I do have I make my own soda water.
You're slowly leveling up.
Slowly leveling up. Okay. Anyway, thanks, ladies. Okay, so now we have reached the second half of our episode, the caryatid. So, Narjiti, can you remind us what a caryatid is, please?
A caryatid is a stone carving of a woman used as a column or a pillar to support the structure of a Greek or Greek-style building. In each episode, we choose a caryatid, a woman who is working today, furthering the profession through their work, and who ties into the historical woman of the episode. Take it away, Jessica.
Lovely. Enchanted, darling. Enchanted. So this week's caryatid goes to... Fabulosity, Carmion Hamilton.
Woo! Carmion.
Yes. Okay, y'all, I love Carmion, okay? In my head, we are friends. We are besties.
Wow.
I've never met her before. I've only seen her through Instagram. But anyway, so Carmion, right? She's based out of Memphis, Tennessee. She is what she calls herself is an environmental curator. She's an interior designer. She is the creator of the brand and company called Newbie Interiors. Also, since everybody knows I like to watch TV, she was last year's winner of the show HGTV Next Design Star. Oh. So by winning that show, she has her own show on the network, and it's called Reno My Rental. So, like I said, I follow her. Yeah, it's really cool because it ties back to Dorothy, and I'll explain. But I follow her on Instagram before she was on the show, and I just loved her content. You know, I loved her as a designer. She herself calls herself a modern bohemian, which kind of reminds me of like Dorothy's like modern baroque, like maximalist, but like Dorothy and Carmion, they both do it in like a tasteful way, you know?
I mean, I'm feeling a connection with Dorothy. Can't wait to watch her show and check out her work.
Yeah, Modern Bohemian, I have to watch that.
Yeah.
Yes. So the premise of our show is it's Reno Her Rental, right? So it's exactly what it sounds like. How can you make spaces like rentals feel more at home without, you know, but still keep your security deposit, if you catch my drift? Like, because, you know, or like, what are easy solutions? And, you know, with her design aesthetic, she exudes confidence, which reminds me of Dorothy, how she did it. She also wants to encourage others to find confidence in curating their own spaces, similar to like what Dorothy was saying with, you know, her design is fun and her design manual. Carmion, for example, in one of her latest, like, well, not latest, but a few months ago, she had like a Instagram live where she goes on this like kind of rant where she says, put the nail in the wall. It's basically, you know, like commit to it. It's not that big of a deal. Like you patch up the hole in the wall, but like commit to making your spaces comfortable and livable and beautiful. Put the nail in the wall.
That should be on a shirt. But also, like, I feel like you're speaking to me because I live in an apartment that I rent and I'm afraid to do anything. Like, I don't want to make it my own. I'm scared of putting anything on the wall. I don't want to lose my deposit. So I will watch this show. I need this lady in my life. I need modern bohemian, modern baroque.
You need some color in your life. But yeah, it's a great show. Just following her on Instagram, Carmion Hamilton. She's doing a beautiful renovation, or she does these little like projects on her house that have been fascinating to watch. She's building a pool in her backyard, and she did like a few months ago, she did a landscaping project, like a full on landscaping project, which was also really fascinating. So people ask me, what do I watch on Instagram? I watch her, and I watch her other interior design friends that she's introduced me to. But anyway, thank you for letting me rant about how much I love Carmion Hamilton.
Thank you for sharing. I'm following her now too.
Yes. Okay. So before we sign off, we would like to give thanks to CMYK for their music. John W., our technical producer, working really hard because we are a hot mess. And most of all, thank you for listening to you all in listeners. You know, we hope you enjoyed learning more about Dorothy and Carmion along with our banter, and that we've inspired you to find out more about them and other amazing professional ladies. So again, thank you.
She Builds Podcast is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. Gable Media is curated thought leadership for an audience dedicated to building a better world. Listen and subscribe to all the shows at gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com.
Please let us know what you thought of our episode. If you enjoyed it, please help us spread the word. You don't know how much that helps. Tell your friends, your people that live in Tuxedo Place, the ones that live in the Upper East Sides, the ones that live in their rented apartments. Give us 5 stars on iTunes. Write us a review. This all helps us reach a wider audience and for more people to learn about amazing ladies with us. And that's what it's about, spreading the word about the Dorothy Drapers of the world.
We are excited to hear from you and for you to come back and keep learning about these literal women bosses with us, because that's our season. You can email us your thoughts at shebuildspodcast@gmail.com. Leave a comment on our website, shebuildspodcast.com, or follow us on Instagram and Facebook at shebuildspodcast and on Twitter at shebuildspod. Until next time, bye!
Ta-ta for bye. Now!
Oh, ta-ta, my darlings. Ta-ta. Ta-ta.
Because of her ex-husband's bestie, FDR. I just also made that connection. I was like, oh.
Hey there, architecture enthusiast. Nikita Reed here, inviting you on an incredible journey through time and space with my podcast, Tangible Remnants. Historic preservation and sustainability? Let's go ahead right now and debunk the myth that they are opposites. In fact, they are two sides of the same coin, shaping our collective future.
In a work environment, it has been challenging because I've had to probably do more than double just to make sure that I quote unquote fit in. But the environments that have allowed me to do me on the front end, I've been extremely successful.
You look at all these PhDs, they've built that on the backs of our elders.
Absolutely.
What they consider themselves to be experts at is what they've worked with us to achieve.
I know we have to prioritize people before products and before place.
Join me as we unravel the stories of historic buildings shaped by the people of a specific era and often influenced by race and gender. These tangible remnants are windows into our past and guideposts for the future. Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe now to Tangible Remnants. Let's explore the interconnectedness of architecture, preservation, sustainability, race, and gender.